Savior, may I learn to love thee, walk the path that thou hast shown. Pause to help and lift another, finding strength beyond my own.
Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at GayMormonStories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
Welcome to Gay Mormon Stories. This is part two of my interview with Kyle Howard. The first part, which hopefully you've heard already, was actually the audio track for the LDS Walk With You video project that Kyle's family did, and included Kyle, his parents, and his brother. That video, which was about an hour long, gives you some helpful information about his family and their perspectives, but the video was really oriented on the parents' experience. And Gay Mormon Stories, sometimes we focus on the parents' experience, but we also want to focus on the gay person and their, in detail, more about their life story and their journey. So today I have Kyle Howard, a good friend of mine, and I'm excited to get more into the details of what happened. So Kyle, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, where you live, and without too much detail, because that'll be part of the journey you're going to explain to us, but just give us the basics of your bio.
Okay. So I'm originally from Laverkan, Utah, was born in St. George, and currently live in Salt Lake. I'm currently working there. I went to school for a few years, but now I'm taking school off right now and working. My family, like my dad's side of the family, most of them live in Laverkan or the area of Laverkan and St. George. And, that's about it.
Okay. Well, why don't you then tell me, let's start with your pre-mission years. So between the ages of 0 and 19, well, first of all, your Mormon experience was, your family experience, that is, was very, very Mormon, right? So your childhood. So why don't you just tell us about what your experience was like growing up in the church, what your family was like, what your attachment was to the church, both in childhood and adolescence. Why don't you just give me a rundown of, in the timeline of that, basically?
Yes, so, I mean, I was raised very active LDS, was baptized by my dad. I remember when I was a little kid, he served as a second counselor in the bishopric, and my mom was in the, was the president of the Young Women's, Stake Young Women's. So my parents were very involved in callings all the time since I can remember, and they still are very involved in callings. We were raised with family home evening every Monday, scripture study every night, family prayer every night, no matter who was home, and very, I guess you could say, Orthodox Mormon, you know, went to church every Sunday. And my dad was the bishop of our ward when I was a teenager, when I was about 10 to 15 years old was when he was bishop. So it was actually kind of a big role player in me hiding my orientation when I was young, because I didn't want my parents to know at all. And so the fact that my dad was my bishop, I couldn't turn to my bishop either. So, but yeah.
And what was your sort of attachment to the church as a teen?
I loved church. It was something it was never something that it was a real burden to me or anything. I believed it strongly, went to seminary, never skipped seminary or anything like that, never skipped church. I was the deacon's quorum president and the teaching's quorum president, and was very involved, like, with the young men even after receiving the Melchizedek priesthood, I still was very involved with them. And
were all your friends in your ward? And
mm-hmm.
was that
yeah,
sort of your social life?
Yeah, my social life was very much friends in the church. In fact, all my high school friends were very active, LDS, very high standards. You know, modesty was important. Getting home on time for our curfews was important. Like, we very much lived our religion. So
you guys were not the troublemakers.
No.
You wouldn't have been hanging out with me. So, okay. But, you know, from your video, you mentioned that you figured out that you were gay pretty mm-hmm. young. Like, were you able to put a name to it when you were an early teen?
Well, I mean, as a kid, I mean, looking back now, I realize there were so many signs of it that since I didn't really know about that at all and wasn't very educated about it, I just didn't realize that that's what was going on. And for some reason, I just realized that this curiosity about men started growing inside of me, and it was just, I thought that it was normal until I realized that all the guys my age at the time, around like 11, 12 years old, were quite different. Like, they were having all these same curiosities about women and about girls our age, and it was just, that's when I started getting kind of scared about it, because I wondered, you know, why is this happening to me?
Yeah.
But then when I started figuring it out, because it was becoming really strong, and even when I was trying to, you know, do what the other boys did, and I remember in third grade, you know, having my first little crush on a girl or whatever, you know, and trying to make that work. But for some reason, as soon as I turned 12, that was when I was in middle school, it just turned around. It was weird. It just, like, I don't know, became really strong. And I tried to fight it, tried to keep it a secret. I thought if I admitted it to myself that it would make it true. And that was the last thing I wanted to be true, so... and I also thought if I would just, you know, live the gospel the best that I could, that it would go away. I remember thinking that a lot. I remember praying a lot about it and trying to figure out some kind of deal I could make with Heavenly Father to somehow make it go away. I thought, well, if I just go on a mission and I, you know, get married in the temple and do everything I'm supposed to, it'll just go away. Kind of had this belief that that would happen. But
did you have a concept of that there was a thing called gay? Did you put that word to it? Did you have this idea in your head? Or
it was more of a fear of being gay, but I never dared admit it to myself.
But you knew the word gay.
But right? Yeah, I knew
Laverkan,
the word gay.
Utah.
Yeah, very
that,
much. Yeah.
You knew what the definition was. Mm-hmm. And so you were, as sheltered as you were in Laverkan, Utah, you knew that there was this thing out there called gay, and you knew that this was what it was, basically.
Yes, but I thought it was, you know, people in San Francisco, or, you know, like, I just didn't have any idea that people around me were gay. I mean, there were other people in my high school, other people my age that were also dealing with these same feelings, and I didn't realize it. I just thought it was something so unheard of, especially in the church. I thought that if you were a good person, that just didn't happen to you. So it really confused me a lot.
Did you get some shaming experiences?
Oh, yeah, I did quite a bit.
What kind of things, like messages in church or what?
Thing is that I believed everything that I was taught in the church about that being wrong. So it wasn't like I didn't feel abused. I abused myself in that way. Like, I would say things to myself that I'm a terrible person. You know, I beat myself up and I just keep thinking, you know, I just need to stop thinking this way. I need to stop having these feelings. And I'd try to fight them all the time. Thought that somehow it was my fault that I had these feelings. And so I just blamed myself for it all along while I was a teenager.
Yeah. Would you say there was hostile rhetoric around you in your community, either in your ward or your school?
There was in school. I mean, we just didn't really talk about it much at church. Like, I remember one time my teacher's quorum advisor mentioned that homosexual behavior is wrong, and he kind of laid down the law and was pinpointed that as something that was bad. But that was the only time that I remember them specifically really teaching that in church, at least to me, other than like in talks. But I remember in high school, there were some kids in high school that were kind of made fun of because people thought that they were gay. And I didn't really know anyone. There was nobody in my high school at the time when I was going through that was really openly gay. Like, yeah. I've had other friends who said that they did have people in their high schools that were really open about that, but that just didn't happen in my high school.
Okay. So was there conflicts then? What did you do after high school? Did you go to BYU or something?
After high school, I went to Utah State for a semester.
Uh-huh.
And that was the same semester. That was the semester I got my mission call, and then I went on my mission just right after. Like right after my finals, I went right into the MTC.
But you didn't bring it up with any church leaders prior to your mission?
No. And I didn't feel worthy to go on my mission. That's something that was just scared me so bad. I didn't want anybody to find out. And I thought that they wouldn't let me go on my mission. And so I kind of, you know, wasn't completely honest in my interviews about it. I left that completely out and just kind of, you know, lied my way through to get to the MTC. And then I realized, you know, that I needed to have the spirit with me in order to be a missionary. And that just kept like pounding my heart, like I can't serve the Lord on a mission if I have this secret that I'm holding on to. Like, I need to let go of it.
Yeah.
And so.
So, did you?
I did. The MTC was the first time I finally, like, confessed that I was gay and had these feelings. And so.
And how was that experience there then?
Yeah. And that was actually quite the amazing experience for me because I really thought I was going to go home. Like, I had convinced myself that I was going to go home. I, like, read the Book of Mormon through all the way for the first time from cover to cover. Like, I'd read it before in seminary and stuff, but I'd never, like, just read it straight through like that.
Yeah.
And did a lot of praying because I was in the MTC for, like, 13 weeks because I was learning Russian. So that's takes a long time to learn. So,
yeah.
So it was plenty of time to have quite the spiritual, like, turning around and coming to Jesus experience, you know. But
your ecclesiastical leader there was sympathetic. He was, I mean, it seems that this is a common thing. So my guess is they get once a week that sort of confession. But
yeah, I'm sure.
But how was it? Was it like, what kind of things did he say? Did he give you sort of real good counsel that in retrospect seems accurate?
He didn't really give a ton of counsel. It was more of a, well, it's a good thing this didn't get any worse, that you didn't do any major sins with this, you know, is what he was telling me. And he was like,
okay,
you know, the Lord still wants you to go on a mission. And so, and I just was amazed. I didn't think I was going to go. I didn't think I was able to.
So you just thought the fact that you were gay or maybe looked at some pornographic pictures online like everybody else, would that might be a great reason to send you home?
Oh, yeah. I had this really strong, like, I didn't realize that everyone had those struggles. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I thought I was the only one, so I thought it was this huge sinner, and then they turned it around on me basically and say, oh, no, you're fine. as long as you don't do it anymore.
Okay.
Anyway.
And so how about your mission then? What? Tell us about that.
So, well, funny thing about that MTC experience is that because I was so set on going home, I was secretly kind of relieved that I wasn't going on my mission because I didn't think I was. Because I was scared to death of going to Russia. That just seemed scary to me. So I was like...
Compared to Laverkin? Russia seems sort of exotic, I suppose.
A little bit. And so I just... When he told me that the Lord still wanted me to serve on a mission and then gave me that basically as an option to say yes or no to, I was just like, whoa, I had to stop and pause for a minute and think, wow, this is like my chance to actually say to God, I'm going to go serve you in Russia for 2 years. And I'll admit it was a little, it, like, made me stop and think about it because I wasn't sure I wanted to go over there. It scared me.
Yeah.
But because my coming to God experience in the MTC was so powerful for me, I felt like, well, if God wants me to do this, then I'm going to go. And so I sucked it up and just said, okay, I'll go.
But, well, can you share more about that? Or it sounds like you had a particular event happen then, a spiritual event? Or...
Yeah, in the MTC,
Do you mind describing it?
Yeah, sure. It started, I mean, it was kind of happening the whole time. I was called to be a district leader in the MTC. And, you know, adding leadership positions when you already don't feel worthy to go on a mission, that just makes you feel more guilty.
Yeah.
So just like, so it was bearing weight on my heart the whole time. And I didn't think I was even worthy to feel the spirit at all. And so I just decided to start praying, like, every night. I just started praying and asking God, you know, I don't know what to do. Like, I really need to figure this out. I need to either go home or I need to, you know, something needs to give here. And there was a talk in a fireside about repentance. And I just remember one, as he was talking about, you know, repenting and being able to feel the spirit again. And I just kept thinking, oh, I want to do that. Like, I want to be able to be a good missionary. I want to feel the spirit. And this voice, like, popped in my head right then that said, you know, you can have that anytime you want. You could have that right now if you wanted to. You know what you have to do. And it kind of woke me up and thought, wow, well, what am I doing just sitting here in this rut? Like, I should do something about this. And so that's when I started praying about it. And I'd have these nights when I'd feel the spirit just flowing through me after crying out these most sincere prayers I had ever said in my life. And after reading the Book of Mormon and praying about it, I started praying and telling God that I just wanted to give my whole life over to him. And it was just like this coming together experience with God. Like, I'd never felt so close to him before in my life up to that point. And so it was really powerful for me, and that's what pushed me to the point of finally saying something to my leaders, my priesthood leader in the MTC.
And, okay, so your confession was actually after that spiritual experience.
Yeah, it was after that. Uh-huh. Or no, the confession was after that. The confession was actually like the day before I left for Russia.
Oh, really? Okay.
And it was because I was doing a special number, a musical number, for the day before I was leaving. And I was worried I was going to be sent home, so I wanted to, like, stay for just long enough to do that special number.
It went well.
So if that
would have been your, you know, going out in a flame, you would have gone out in a flame.
I guess so. I guess you could say that.
But anyway, you didn't go out in a flame. You got on a plane, so.
Yeah, exactly. And my priestly leader, that was one thing he said about it, though. He asked me, well, have you felt the spirit since you've been here in the MTC? And I looked back and realized I'd had all these amazing spiritual experiences. And I thought, well, yes. And so he's like, well, obviously you're still worthy for the spirit. And so that kind of hit me too. But
yeah, well, it was a nice thing for him to say.
Yeah, it was. And okay. Then he got on a plane.
So you got to Russia a little bit jet lagged, I suppose, and excited
It was exactly what I was imagining it was going to be like from the moment I got off the plane.
Yeah.
The sky was gray. The buildings had like soot on them, you know. And
did you arrive in the winter?
Yeah, I arrived in early March.
Okay, so kind of a dreary time.
Yeah, kind of towards the end of winter.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was like just pollution everywhere. The sun was red in the sky. Every Russian on the street had their big shapka, you know, fur hats.
Yeah.
And I was just like, whoa, I was in so much culture shock. It was crazy.
Yeah. So, well, keep going. Tell us about it.
Well, it was amazing because I didn't really, there's something about serving a mission and just leaving the world behind you and forgetting about everything that puts all your troubles that you had at home just kind of, they're kind of put on the back burner, I guess, because you don't really have to focus on them. And so me being gay wasn't really a big issue on my mission, like, other than, you know, occasional experiences where, like, my companion would take off his shirt or something, and then it's like, oh, you know, having to turn and look away and just feel uncomfortable, you know, things like that. Okay. But other than that, it was never really, like, a big issue at all. And it was something I could easily control.
Okay, but, so there wasn't problematic, this intense sort of male bonding that goes on a mission.
Yeah, no, it wasn't really that bad. And it's probably just because I had such a mindset of I have to be good, because otherwise somebody will find out, or, you know, I won't be able to be a good missionary and the work won't happen. And, you know.
Were most of your companions other Americans, or were you paired
yes,
up with the Russians?
Okay. But my first companion was a Ukrainian.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, he was a big guy. And he was really scary. He kind of scared me when I first met him. He was big. But then I learned he was just a teddy bear. He was just, you know, really lovable and easy to get along with. Well, not easy for me to get along with, because I felt so alone being with a Ukrainian companion, not speaking the language very well. But, and we were so different culturally, but other than that, he was really nice. So,
okay. But were you one of those missionaries that just was super, then you were super obsessed with obeying all the rules? And
it was at first. Then halfway through, I had a couple companions who were pretty lax on the rules. So I was one of those missionaries that kind of basically did what my companion was doing. Okay. I didn't like, unless they were really, you know, not following the rules at all, then I would start being passive aggressive and trying to figure out ways to make us work harder. But
you weren't like on their cases all the time, so you have to be out there.
No, I wasn't. No. Towards the end of my mission, I really picked it up and started working really hard. And I was called to a zone leader, and I trained a missionary. My last companion was somebody I trained. And it was just something about, you know, training missionary. Every missionary knows this who's trained somebody. Suddenly you're, you know, you pick up your obedience and really try to work hard on being a good missionary. But, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I trained the last one I trained too, but it was a little bit different. My job was to keep him from going home.
Oh, really?
Because he was, like, barely hanging in there. So it wasn't all about, like, obeying every single rule, I'll tell you.
Oh,
but
I see.
Anyway, it sounds different than yours.
Maybe a little bit.
But anyway, it worked out. He later told the mission president I was the only companion he liked. So
oh, really?
I guess everyone else was being harder on him.
Oh.
Or maybe I got him off to a bad start by being lax. I don't know.
That's but anyway. Funny. Yeah, my last companion was my favorite one, actually.
Oh,
it was really awesome.
So you, by the end, were you just ready to go home, or did you really settle into the experience? Or
I mean, it became comfortable enough, but I mean, now I probably, if I were to go on a mission now, I'd be way different. But at the time, I was really shy and really closed off to people, because I had done that my whole life, trying to keep people from finding out that I was gay. And so it was very uncomfortable for me talking to people, especially contacting on the street, which we did every day, all the time. Because the work in Russia, you know, doesn't really involve members very much, because there aren't a lot of them over there. So, yeah, that was really hard. And to be able to not have to worry about that stress anymore was really nice. But I'm really glad for the experience. I wouldn't trade it for anything. But it was definitely really hard, and it definitely felt like 2 years. Like, when I started going home, it was like, okay, you know, I'm good. Yeah. Time to go home.
You did your duty. So, yeah. And your mom got sick while you were out there. And you didn't really mention, like, did they tell you the whole story, or did they kind of protect you a little? So you knew what was going on. Did that sort of distract you in a big way, or where did you put that?
No, for me, it was actually really nice. My dad keeps a journal like every day, and like pictures on his journal as well. And so he printed his journals out and mailed them to me like letters.
Uh-huh.
And so I got to read and then look at pictures of what's happening at home. So I really didn't feel like I was missing out on anything at home, which actually was really nice, because I didn't have to sit there and worry, you know, about, oh, like what's happening at home and missing out on everything. You know, I didn't have to feel homesick. I never really felt homesick. So, because I didn't really feel like I was missing out.
Yeah.
But,
great.
Yeah, that's how I found out about everything that was happening with my mom getting sick, because my dad basically wrote everything that was happening and then sent it to me. So
okay.
I felt like I was there.
Okay. Well, in the other video, we kind of heard about, you know, you got home and you, not too long after you told your parents, you had your sister supporting that.
Mm-hmm.
And that your response was, well, it sounds like you were kind of, were you surprised that their response was so tolerant, was so loving, or were you expecting that kind of based on this new attitude that your family was showing, your parents were showing?
I mean, I was still worried about how they would react because this was still quite the issue to bring up.
Yeah.
Even though they were suddenly really loving and non-judgmental, and I was like blown away. And I know that I wouldn't have gotten to the point where I felt okay about telling them if they weren't that way.
Okay.
At least so soon. But the biggest motivator was that prompting I got that was just really strong. Like, Kyle, it's time to tell them. And I was just like, ugh. Yeah. Didn't want to do it. But I was pleasantly surprised that they actually were still staying true to the way they were now with being so loving. And they didn't even, I mean, I know inside they were like sick and thinking, oh my gosh, like, I can't believe this is happening to us. But they didn't really show it to me. They were just really loving and supportive and just said, well, Kyle, we'll love you and support you no matter what you choose to do with your life.
Yeah.
And so, and then they went, you know, in their own bedroom by themselves at their own time and, you know, went through whatever they had to go through getting the emotions right out. But I didn't see it, so.
But what I gathered from the you know, your interview with them was that in a way they were ahead of you already, that
mm-hmm.
that they kind of said, whatever you decide, but you were kind of, no, don't you worry. I'm going to be celibate or whatever. I mean, isn't. So in a way they gave you the okay to make your choices,
mm-hmm.
but you weren't on that. You weren't there yet.
No, I wasn't. I mean, I was to the point of, okay, gay people aren't necessarily evil or bad. You know, I was to that point, at least. But I still wasn't okay. Like, to me, it was still a sin to be gay. Like, it wasn't okay, you know? Like,
did you have any discussions with your mission president or your bishop after you got home?
I did with my bishop when I got home, but my mission president, we almost talked about it and the phone rang during our interview.
Oh,
and okay. And he'd forgotten about it by the time he was done with the phone call. So I was like, okay, I'm not going to bring it up.
Okay.
Saved by the phone.
Maybe that was for the best.
Maybe it was.
Okay. So then tell us about your journey. Cause it sounds like you went through sort of a range of ideas with that, your evolution with that.
I did. So, I mean, at this time, I still felt like I was the only one that was, you know, experiencing this. But I kind of started doing the same things as my parents and investigating what the pure love of Christ is and praying about it and having these profound spiritual experiences and realizing that I was okay and whole just the way I am. That was huge for me because I just thought I was broken. You know, I thought I had to fix this. And even uh-huh. after that, having those experiences, I still felt like I wanted to change my orientation because I wanted a family so bad. Like, I wanted a wife and kids, and I wanted to get married in the temple and stay in the church, you know, and so I tried to figure that out. My dad happened, because he was in the High Council, he happened to get a pamphlet on Evergreen like 2 weeks before I came out to my parents. And he was uh-huh. like, well, and he was the only one that got them because they kind of brought it up in the meeting and were like, oh, you know, and they all got awkward. And he just kind of took it and put it in his briefcase.
Okay.
So he happened to be the one that took it. And so he knew about it. So he called the people and we set it up for me to go and meet with them. And I mean, that was a really good experience for me because I went and got to see that there were other members of the church who were dealing with the same thing and that I wasn't alone. And that was huge for me. It was a big eye opener.
So tell me, where was that?
It was in St. George.
Okay.
We had a place where we met every Wednesday.
Uh-huh.
And it was actually monitored by a senior missionary couple.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, they kept telling us that, you know, this is not affiliated with the church, and yet they had missionaries there running it. But but they, it was very much, it almost felt like ward family prayer, or like, you know, a devotional or something, where we would just come, we'd basically tell each other our struggles that week, you know, and then we'd have a spiritual thought trying to boost us back up, and then we'd go home. And so at first, like, that was fine, because I was, you know, realizing I'm not alone and that there's things I can do about this. And but then I ended up moving to Logan again to go to school to continue my education there. And I joined the Evergreen group there. And I made some friends there. But, I mean, it started getting to the point where it was, like, the same thing every week. And it was just kind of like, well, I didn't really... It wasn't really doing much for me. Like, I'd gone thinking, you know, that this is going to help me somehow fix my orientation, or somehow somebody will have the secret somewhere, you know. They'll figure it out and they're going to share it with me, or, you know, the church knows how to become straight, so let's, you know.
Yeah.
I want to learn that, but nobody had any of that. Nobody knew. I mean, it didn't matter what therapist, it didn't matter what, I mean, you know, people would have their ideas of what to do, but it was, I mean, I'd try the things and they just felt like I was just suppressing my sexuality. Like, I didn't really feel like I was really changing anything.
Trying things. I mean, were you doing the joining their softball team and that business that they used to do, or?
No, I didn't join the softball team, but I did go to Journey into Manhood.
Okay. While you were in Evergreen.
While I was in Evergreen, yeah. Because my friend at the time, my really close college buddy, we had met in Evergreen, and he decided to go to Journey into Manhood, and he got me excited to go as well. So we decided to both go. We flew to Florida, and it was like this, I can't remember, was it 3 days or a week? I think it was at least 3 days, a kind of a camp, and just to kind of get over, you know, like our beliefs about things and our walls when it comes to women. And I guess their whole philosophy was, well, we need to basically reconstruct what you should have done when you were a teenager of becoming attracted to women and becoming curious about them.
Uh-huh.
And then changing your relationship with men to a healthy one, is the word they would use, to one that wasn't sexual at all. And so I learned a lot. I actually gained a lot of really helpful tools from going to that I still use today. Like, one tool I got was learning to just face my fears. Like, if I see a fear, I just need to go to where that fear is and face it. That's helped me with, like, so many other things in my life. But for me, it didn't do anything to change my orientation. And I mean, I have never found a single woman ever that I've been attracted to, like, not even one. So maybe that has something to do with it. Maybe you have to be at least a little bit bi. I don't know. You know?
Well, it's, I don't know, easier if you're actually attracted, right?
Yeah, it's much easier if you're actually attracted.
These guys won't say they're bi, but mm-hmm. My definition of bi is you have some attraction to women, but you're primarily gay. That's more bi than you or me, because I'm kind of like you. I'm just never attracted to women. But, mm-hmm. But it certainly is different if you do versus if you don't have that attraction at all, right?
Yeah. And so, like, the biggest thing for me is that I just noticed that a lot of the men who went to Journey into Manhood were already married and were trying to make their marriage work.
Uh-huh.
And it made sense to me. I'm like, if I was already married, I would be trying to do everything I possibly could to somehow make that marriage work, you know, because I wouldn't want it to end. But I didn't feel that kind of pressure because I wasn't married yet. So it's like, well, I don't want to get into a marriage unless I can find a woman I'm attracted to. So until I do that, you know.
Okay.
But it wasn't working.
So, like, you went one time, huh?
I went to one weekend and then set up this program that they gave. And they had other ones that we could follow up on. But, I mean, they travel around to different states depending on the month. And, I mean, it's it's like $600 or something. I think that's how much I paid for it, something like that. So it's pricey. It's not exactly the cheapest thing to do. But
yeah, for a young college student.
Yeah, for a young college student. And so I just did everything that they'd give me, like the tools and everything, and nothing was working. And it was kind of getting frustrating because I'm like, okay, like I'm doing everything, I mean, that I know to do. I mean, I went online to, you know, people who had claimed that they'd gotten over being gay, you know, and like they were straight now, and reading what they had to say about it, and then trying out what they were saying to do. And I tried studying what it's like to be a straight man, like what differences they have from gay men, and like trying to adopt those kind of behaviors and habits, and you know, everything. I just everything I could think of.
Yeah.
But I mean, I did notice a huge shift in how my relationship with straight men changed. Suddenly I wasn't so intimidated by them anymore, and I didn't feel so different from them. I actually felt like just another guy, and that was good.
Uh-huh.
That made it so I could actually relate to other guys a lot more, and that really helped. But it didn't make the attraction go away. So
okay. Let me just ask you a couple more questions about Evergreen. Uh-huh. What years were you? This is right after your mission?
Yeah, so it was 2008.
Okay.
I think it was the spring, I think, is when I started going.
How big was exactly. The St. George group?
How many of us were there? I think regularly we had at least 5 guys show up.
And in Logan?
And in Logan, there were about 5 or 6, I'd say, uh-huh. About.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And were you making friends in both these groups, or?
I did. I mean, I wasn't able to stay friends with the ones in St. George for that long because I moved pretty soon after.
Yeah.
But the ones in Logan, I became pretty good friends with, especially the one I went to Journey into Manhood with.
Okay. So. I hate to jump ahead of it, but what would you say came of these guys? I mean, say you had 5 sort of peers in the Evergreen.
Mm-hmm.
Is it your sense that they, 5 years later, they're, you know, out of the 5, do you have a sense of where they are in their, if they're out of the church, if they're in the church, if they entered mixed orientation marriage?
So some of them, I mean, there were a few of them that were already married. And since then, I mean, married and like older men who have families and kids, okay, that are actually like grown up and getting married. So it's like not exactly.
Okay. You know. So these weren't 5 guys your age. These was.
No, not all of them. Okay, about half of them were my age.
Okay.
Let's see. I remember there were like 1 or 2 who were single, but were older. And they'd been staying single their whole lives. And then there was, the ones my age, out of the ones that came pretty regularly, most of them now have like left the church and are, you know, dating other men.
Okay.
Only one of them, in fact, there's only one that I know went and got married to a woman in the temple and is still going to church. And that's the one I went to Journey into Manhood with.
Okay.
And we're still really good friends. We still keep in touch, and he just had a new baby.
Okay.
Girl, just a little bit ago.
Interesting. So, yeah. I just have a guess. I mean, a lot of people have described to me that sort of scenario of just being desperate to resolve or get rid of basically your sexual orientation,
mm-hmm,
caused a lot of despair. But I'm also hearing you say that you were coming from a perspective that you'd had the spiritual experience that Christ accepted you. And at this point, you were really just doing it because you thought it was a life you wanted, but it wasn't. You, at this point, were you putting your self-worth on it? Or do you think you had that those spiritual experiences helped you move beyond that?
Well, the spiritual experiences, I mean, it might help make a little more sense if I described one of them.
Uh-huh.
Because then it would kind of make more sense where I was coming from after those spiritual experiences. Because I no longer believed that being gay was wrong. By this point, I didn't believe it was wrong. Like, I didn't want to be gay, and I thought that would be a really hard life. And I thought, you know, I want to get married to a woman and have kids, you know, and stay in the church. But I didn't believe that being gay was wrong.
Okay. Did you believe that it would have been wrong for you to start dating a guy? Or was that included in this isn't wrong from your perspective at that time?
I wasn't ready to toy with that idea in my head because I was like, well, it's like in theory I didn't believe it was wrong anymore because of the spiritual experiences I had, but I still had, you know, that like fear that, well, what if it really is wrong, you know, like,
okay.
Or what if I'm not supposed to be gay, you know, what if I'm supposed to marry a woman? And so it's, yeah, yeah. I didn't dare really go there yet.
Yeah. Well, please describe that yeah. spiritual.
Yeah. So
experience, it sounds like it.
So I was very involved in the church after my mission. I mean, I was very active in church. I was executive secretary. I was ward organist in every ward that I was in. I taught a gospel doctrine class and gospel principles class. I was involved in the institute choir. I was in the presidency of the institute choir. Was involved in the leadership there. It was very much a part of my life. And one of the things I did was I did EFY one of the summers. It was the summer of 2009 at BYU.
And you were working as an EFY counselor?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's an intense.
Yes.
I did Pioneer Trek, so.
Oh.
And back then, Pioneer Trek was sort of a sister to EFY. We were BYU employees, and they all came and did our program. Now it's different. They, you know, each state kind of does their own. But back then, it was sort of like, just like EFY. So anyway, I know how that is, and it was fun.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But anyway, keep going.
Yeah. I taught for about 6 weeks. My last week, I had these kids that were pretty difficult to teach at EFY. They were all out of state, so they didn't really know the Utah culture very well. And I didn't really stop to think about that, you know, well, this is kind of, you know, out of their culture. They're not really used to this. But they were, you know, breaking rules, and they were, you know, kind of a hard group to teach. They wouldn't listen to the lessons. They really kind of disrespected us, EFY counselors. It was kind of difficult.
Yeah.
And, I was getting really frustrated. I was having such a hard time. And so I decided that something needed to change, but I knew that it had to start with me. And so when we had our scripture studies one morning, I decided to look up charity and see, okay, how can I, you know, develop charity? And I was reading in the Book of Mormon, in Moroni, where it talks about, I can't remember if it's chapter 7 or chapter 8, where it talks about the pure love of Christ. That charity is the pure love of Christ. And the scripture really hit me was, pray unto the Father that you may be filled with this love that he hath bestowed upon all who are true disciples of his Son. And I just thought, you know, I thought, well, maybe I should try this, you know, like experiment on what Moroni is saying here. And so I decided to just give it a try and pray and ask that that love would be filled in my heart. And in that prayer, I said, you know, let me see these kids through your eyes. And it was like, as soon as I was done with the prayer, I opened my eyes and looked around, and I just had this overwhelming feeling come over me of just almost like someone opened up my skull and poured a bunch of just pure white love like all over in me. It was just like, whoa, like it was intense. I started looking around to start bawling, like having this kind of like spiritual experience where I'm bawling my eyes out. And it was so interesting because I learned so much in that moment. The first thing that came to me was that everything is okay. Everything is in divine order and everything is perfect. I'd never had an experience like that before. And as I looked around, it was just like, these kids are perfectly okay. I don't have to worry about them. And I realized that God only sees perfection, at least from the experience I was having when I asked for that. And this is what I was experiencing, that God only sees perfection. And I just felt this overwhelming love for these kids and realize they're exactly in the place they should be experiencing and learning exactly what they're supposed to right now. And so suddenly I didn't worry about them anymore. And instead, what replaced the worry was just this deep love and respect for them as spirit beings of God, you know, like these spirit children that he loves so much. And that's all I cared about, was that they felt that love that I was feeling from God in that moment. And so, and it was like I'd forgotten about myself, and all I was doing was just worrying about everybody else, making sure they felt good and that they felt loved. And it was like this shift happened in all those EFY kids, because suddenly they could tell where I was coming from, that I suddenly had this new love and respect for them, and they reflected it back. They suddenly started showing love and respect for me. And by the end of that week, we were like best friends, and I had a really hard time letting them go. So <Yeah. laughs> it was amazing. I was like, wow. And seeing the change, when a heart changes, everything else just changes along with it. Like the whole head battling thing is just unnecessary. And so having that experience of realizing everybody is, and everything that God has created is perfect, just changed, you know, like changed my perception on the world. Cause I thought, well, then if I'm experiencing being gay and that's perfect, having this experience, then I don't know why I need to be hating myself and beating myself up for it.
Right.
So
you could apply it to others, and you could apply mm-hmm. it to yourself.
Exactly.
And so that's charity.
Yep.
Okay. So you took that, and you were, you know, like I say, I've heard people really, you know, I've heard a lot of the negative side. I know there's people who've had positive experiences with their different experiences in Evergreen and Journey into Manhood and things like that. But because of the people I happen to talk to, I hear more of the negative experiences, and that mm-hmm. makes me think, you know, that there is plenty of people certainly who find a lot of despair from their experience there. It sounds like you were protected against that by this experience you had, in a way. I don't know if you saw this phenomenon, other people around you who were just battling really low self-esteem, and that this was driving their involvement. Did you see that in any of your peers in Evergreen?
For them, it was like I wanted to share with them how I was feeling in my experience, but I couldn't, because it's not something you can just give to somebody else or tell them about it, because they just don't get it. You know, you can't get something like that unless you experience it yourself. And so I knew that until they had that experience themselves, they weren't going to know that. That was actually something that I got to share with one of my groups of UFY kids, as I challenged them that night to go pray and ask God how he felt about them. And some of them came out of their bedrooms just bawling their eyes out, just like having this amazing experience where they felt this overwhelming love from Heavenly Father for them. And I just feel like that's, people need to have those experiences on their own. They can't be given that. Yeah. And so as much as I wanted to share that with them, I knew I really couldn't just tell them that. They had experienced themselves. But most of them were just in total turmoil and confusion, and they didn't understand, and they just seemed to be so lost. They just had no idea which way to turn, because it's like, well, this feels so natural and is such a part of me, and yet it's so wrong, you know, and yet I have to somehow get rid of it to be in the church. And it just was so conflicting.
Yeah.
But
so did you kind of move on from Evergreen then, or did you move over to North Star?
I did. My friend and I both moved on, and I never actually got involved really with North Star. Like I think I joined the Facebook group. That's about all I did. I didn't really get too involved. I mean, I read articles that the church had put out, and that, like, Ty Mansfield, I mean, I read his book, you know, I did a lot of things like that, but I had never, like, I went to the Mattis Firesides a couple times. Other than that, I didn't really get that involved with them.
Okay.
So,
but then how did it sounds like after that it became a personal journey, so.
Yeah, by then it was a very personal journey. So, because I kind of realized, I don't know, seeing these people being involved in these things and feeling like they're being tossed back and forth, I just thought, well, I don't want to be part of that battle of being tossed back and forth and not knowing where to go and what to do. Like, I figured the best person who knows what to do is God. So I'm just going to go ask him.
Okay.
So that's kind of my take on it. So,
So how long had this been after your mission when you kind of were getting to that point?
So that experience at EFY was in 2009. I got home December of 2007, so a couple of years.
Okay. And that's around that time that you also stopped going to Evergreen.
Yes. Let's see. When did I stop going to Evergreen? I stopped going to Evergreen. When was it? It was probably the summer after that. So the next year, 2010.
Okay.
I think. Yes.
Okay. So, well, keep going then.
Okay.
Well, did that coincide with when you left Logan?
No, I was in Logan this whole time. I stayed in Logan clear until the end of 2012.
Okay.
So, I mean, some of the summers I went home for the summer, but mostly I stayed in Logan. So it was actually the end of 2010 that I went to Journey into Manhood. Went through all that program, you know, like trying to somehow make it work. And all those other things that came along with it. I mean, I could go forever talking about all the different things I tried. And of course, trying to pray it away or trying to make it clear. But the thing was, is that I wanted that so badly, I didn't really dare pray and ask God what he wanted. Or if I should really, you know, get married to a woman, or if I should stay celibate, or if I should get married to man. Like, I didn't dare ask that question. But that time was kind of my time of getting a really strong relationship with God. I mean, I had moments when many times I'd go to the top of the mountain and just pray, and like went to the temple many times. I just was very focused on learning. I studied the scriptures like crazy. I was always just seeking, you know, keeping prayer journals and writing down the answers as they'd come to me. Like, I'd never been so close to God before in my life, not even on my mission. It was a very spiritual time for me. Wow. And I had a lot of amazing experiences that are too sacred for me personally to share. But it got to the point where I trusted all the answers I was getting because they were so profound and edifying for me. And building that trust with God was really important for me to finally get to the point where I am now, because I don't think I would let myself accept the answers I got if I didn't trust where they were coming from. And and I realize not everybody is like super spiritual in that way. But so this is just my personal experience, just what I personally went through. By the time I had gone to Journey into Manhood and seeing that it wasn't working and realizing, okay, like, I probably need to start facing this question of what to do next. I probably should start, you know, praying and asking God. Now that I have this relationship with him, I need to, like, trust and not worry about what the answer is. And I had to get to a point where I was okay with what the answer was, no matter what the answer was. Because yeah. I was thinking, you know, if I just strongly believe that being gay is wrong, then I'm never going to find out whether that's really true. If I'm never going to open my mind enough to really actually ask God and see if that's true. And so when I was finally okay with any answer I got, and I knew that I was ready, so I specifically, like, my mom remembers this because I called her right afterwards, and my parents were in Hawaii on a trip. Uh-huh. But I went to a park, and I like said, okay, this is it. I'm gonna pray, and I'm gonna, you know, write down the answers that I get. And I was ready, because by that time I was getting answers like right away. It was not even a problem getting answers to my prayers. And I prayed and finally asked the question.
Yeah.
And the answer I got, I wrote down, I don't have it with me right now, but I'm gonna paraphrase, because I mean, I don't know if I'd be willing to share all of it, but it said, well, you know, this question's been on your mind for a really long time, and now that you're ready to receive this answer, you're also ready to act on whatever answer you get. So I was like, oh boy, you know, as I got it. But the answer I got was that it didn't matter what life I chose, like whether I got married to a woman, stayed celibate, or got married to a man, I would be okay, that I'm still loved, that I had nothing to worry about, that God would still love me and I didn't have to worry about that. And then the answer I got was just a very fair, balanced weight of what each choice meant. Uh-huh. And I didn't really get a sense from my answer that there was one right way to do it, or there was, you know, you need to get married to a man or you need to get married to a woman. Like, it was not like that. He just said, well, if you do this, this is what would happen, and these are the things you'd learn from it. If you, you know, stay celibate, this is what you would learn. And then the last part of it was just, you'd be fine no matter what answer you chose, but you would be most fulfilled in this life if you got married to a man. And that put it in perspective for me, because, you know, this life and, like, the most fulfilled, I just kind of sat with that for a little bit and thought, okay, I don't really know what I'm going to do with this, but I'll sit and ponder on it for a long time. And I got a lot of peace about it. And that's when I had the thought, thinking about my mom's kitchen, because she had this wallpaper that she didn't really like, but because somebody else, that was a friend of hers, had picked it out, she felt obligated to, you know, buy it and put it up. And it was one of those things where she realized, well, if I'm the one living in the kitchen every day and nobody else really sees it, then I need to make my kitchen the way that's pleasing to me, because I'm the one that has to, you know, see it every day.
Right.
And so it hit me that that's the same with me and my life. Like, I realized that the reason why I wanted to get married to a woman and have kids is because that's what everybody else wanted me to do. And that didn't sit well with me. I was like, I don't want to make this decision because of everyone else. I want to make the decision that I want, that would be best for me, you know, because it's my life. I'm the one that has to live with it every day and face it every day. And if it's something that's painful for me or something that's difficult that I can't get enjoyment out of, then there's no point. So.
But it sounds like the answer to that prayer, or at least the various answers to the prayers you got, helped you let go that there was an eternal consequence. I mean, of course, mm-hmm. Mormons believe there is,
mm-hmm.
or we're told there is, that we're going to be damned to hell or whatever. But,
mm-hmm.
but your prayers definitely told you that that wasn't the case, that, that there was no particular eternal advantage to one path over the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so the advantage to this path was temporal. You will have a better life with this choice, but mm-hmm. eternally you're going to be fine in any of those three choices.
Yeah.
And that was really, for you, it was direct revelation, that is the kind of revelation we strive as Mormons to have, right? That's
exactly.
That we've learned all our lives that we are entitled to.
And it's interesting, because another experience I had earlier before I had this one was where I kind of had this vision that I got of my future kids, but there was no wife. There was nobody. And I asked about that, and then, you know, I just prayed and asked, you know, why was I only shown kids and no spouse? And he said, well, it's because that's your choice. You're the one that gets to choose who or what that's going to be.
Okay.
And so that was kind of a seed planted in my mind back in the time, but.
Okay.
So by this time I realized, okay, like, there really isn't, like, I'm not being pressured either way. Like, God loves me no matter what path I choose. And so I decided, well, then I'm going to ponder on this and then choose to do the thing that makes me the happiest. And so.
Well, let me just throw a little analysis on that, though. You know, obviously some people would hear this and go, well, obviously God didn't give you that message. You wanted that so much that you gave yourself that message.
Mm-hmm.
How would you respond?
Well, I would say that it's easy to see it that way and to think that that's what it was that was happening to me. But for my own personal experience, it is 100% clear in my mind of where that came from and what that answer meant. I mean, I don't believe that everybody gets necessarily the same answer. I believe that everybody gets the answer that they need to hear, that they're ready for, or that would best serve them. Because it's like shirts, not one size fits all. You know, everybody, some things work better for other people than others. And for me, that's why it wasn't one of those things, okay, everybody, this is what every gay person should do. You know, I got this answer, everybody else should do this too. Like, it was not that kind of thing. It was a very personal revelation that I personally received and felt like that's what God wanted me to do. And yeah. So that's what I'm choosing to do with my own personal life. And I don't think that there's any right or wrong way for anybody else to live their life. So
you think it's perfectly possible that another person could pray and get a totally different answer, mm-hmm. and it could have been just as divine.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, whatever answer that is of like, well, this is the answer for everybody. I mean, everybody will get what they feel like is the truth for that. But as far as getting their own personal revelation of what they should do with their own life, absolutely.
Okay. So when this sort of sounded like it was a, you know, you had a lot of spiritual experiences that were pivotal points, but this was a particularly pivotal point where mm-hmm. that possibility became real. How long ago was that?
This was about spring or summer of 2011.
Okay. And so where did you go with that?
Well, I ended up meeting, becoming friends with a guy actually in the Latter-day Voices choir, the Institute choir in Logan.
Okay.
And he was also gay. And the most crazy circumstances happened that kind of blew my mind. I was like, wow. Like, it's like really paid attention to it because it was really, I don't know. Just how we ended up becoming friends, because we weren't supposed to. I almost left the choir because I was, you know, working so hard on becoming, you know, somehow becoming attracted to women. But we ended up becoming really good friends and then admitted to each other that we liked each other. And then we started dating. We were really good, though. We were good little Mormon boys. We didn't really do much. So. but we did fall pretty hard for each other, Phil. It was weird. It was like, wow, this is what straight people are talking about falling in love. Like, it was the first time I'd ever experienced that. It was crazy to actually know what the love songs mean and, you know, like everything.
Yeah.
And after that, I was like, okay, now that I know what that feels like to feel such deep love for somebody else, like, I don't ever want to live my life without that.
Okay.
Because it's so meaningful, and I realized how much it helps you improve as a person, because you're, you know, building a relationship with somebody, and that's probably the biggest refiner of character than anything, you know. And I wanted that. I knew that that's what I wanted for my life, and so that made that decision a lot easier of what exactly I wanted to do with my life. And
so it was a positive experience, just mm-hmm. knowing this, and it was your first dating experience that a lot of us have, well, straight people have younger probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was 24, so
yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, it ended because he felt really guilty about it, but and I didn't, because I was over the guilt feeling about it by then.
Yeah.
But it was a really good experience. And another thing about it is, because I've stayed so close, at least I feel I've stayed really close to God, I felt a lot of guidance as far as how I should live my life. And I feel like a lot of people, not to judge them in any way, I don't want to make them feel like the way they're choosing to live their life is wrong by any means, but just, I feel like a lot of people will just take, well, the church won't accept me because I'm gay, so I'm just going to leave the church and then do everything that the church teaches against, you know, like everything, and kind of experiment everything the world has to offer, basically. And I mean, I can see what can motivate that, but I never had that kind of motivation, because my motivation was a very spiritual one to actually dating guys. And so I've still like never tried alcohol. Like I don't, I live a very LDS lifestyle. I still keep God very close to me and pray and meditate all the time. And I mean, I still read my scriptures. Like although I kind of feel like I have my own personal religion now because I'm not active in church anymore. I mean, I feel like a lot of things that are taught at church are just so different than the way I see the world now, and that I'm not really completely accepted as a gay person, but I'm still very spiritual and keep God very close to me. And I still keep all of the people who are members of the church and like family and stuff like that. I still keep them very close to me. They're very important to me. So. Yeah.
And so now you're a single 20-something-year-old guy who is
yep.
who is exploring that part of life.
I am, and I have to admit I'm kind of picky because it's difficult finding guys that feel the same way I do. It's, you know, it's definitely a challenge finding guys that are still, you know, very spiritual or at least to some extent and that live the same kind of lifestyle I live. That's...
Yeah.
You know, it's not the easiest thing to find, but...
It's not, but it's a good idea to... I mean, I think it's probably... I would probably tell you, if this was my personal advice, you know, date a variety of people. But yeah, in the end, you really want to form a relationship with someone who can at least, you know, help you be the person you want to be. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think lowering your standards is a good idea. Unless you're being ridiculously unrealistic.
I don't think I am.
I can't make that assessment. So, but I mean, yeah. It's okay to hold out for a while. You're young. But let's talk about this past year, because that's when I got to know you. I don't know. I think I have to tell my side of the story, because my connection with Kyle came through the Walk With You project. Which, you know, came, me and Berta Marquez were talking. I had given a presentation at Affirmation in September of 2013. So, it was kind of on people having affirming spiritual experiences, kind of like the one you described. In fact, if I had interviewed you by then, you would have been part of that presentation. I had a collection of vignettes like that I actually played the audio for the presentation. But after I did that presentation, I said, well, next year I want to do the same thing but with parents. And so I had that in my head, and at the same time, Dan Savage started a video campaign for Christians called Not All Like That, where they were asking Christians to express their support for gay people, just to prove that not all Christians were homophobic. And I kind of got the idea that this needed to be we needed a Mormon version of that. And so within a couple of days, that I had that idea in my head, and I visited with Berta Marquez, and she said the same thing. She actually came up with the idea that was already in my head. So both of us independently thought of it. So we said, okay, this has to happen. And so Berta kind of got me going, and she had sort of enough knowledge that she could kind of push me to, she helped me choose a camera and buy a camera, and we decided we were going to do interviews for a video project for parents. And so, so that was in September of 2013. So Kyle's not part of the story yet. I didn't even know him. But I did put out a sort of a call for help in some of the online forums. And one of the calls for help was a campaign to choose a name. And so I just, in the group, it's LDS Family Fellowship, I just put it out there. We're doing this. We need a name. And people were throwing out names. And we had a bunch of ideas. And finally, Kathy Carlston, who becomes part of this story, said, well, why don't we call it I'll Walk With You, kind of in honor of Carolyn Pearson's song. And that just seemed right from the minute she said that. And so I had offered a prize that whoever came up with the name would win a My Little Pony. And Kathy won. She got the My Little Pony. But what really came of that was just the serendipitiness of it, because I had gotten with Berta sort of in a serendipitous way that seemed kind of inspired. So Berta and I had met serendipitously, but Kathy, once she had become the person who named the project, she ended up offering her services, and she said, well, I can help with some design, I can help with some video editing. And this was fantastic because I knew nothing about video editing. So we kind of had our third person on board. So we got the project going. I videotaped Esther, which was a friend of mine in Montreal who was part of the, who was a former ballerina, and she just did a wonderful interview. She's a believing Mormon who also supports gay people. I sent it off to Kathy. Kathy made this fantastic video. And we used this video to create a concept of a message for Mormon parents. But around that time, I came out to Utah, and just around that time, I got a email out of the blue from Kyle. And Kyle said, oh, you know, we have an interesting story, and he was basically offering it for Gay Mormon Stories, and I guess I'm taking him up on it right now, but he kind of told me a story, and I kind of was saying, well, you know, that sounds really great. He talked about his mom and being sick, and you talked about your mom. I'm talking about you in third person, but Kyle offers to do that, and I said, well, Gay Mormon Stories has kind of taken a hiatus now because I'm busy with this other project. And so I kind of set aside, but I said, but listen, Affirmation and the LDS Family Fellowship, they're having this gathering the weekend before Thanksgiving. I'm going to be in town. You should go to it because you should, those sound like fun. So I had just dropped that hint to Kyle, and that was it. That was the one time I talked to him. So we went to that Affirmation dinner. It was to celebrate Thanksgiving. Berta and Kathy were there. We had a big meeting about the Walk With You project, and Berta and I decided to announce it that we needed volunteers to the crowd who was there. So we did, and we only had one response, but it was Kyle. So thank goodness he came, because he came up to me and said, yeah, I've done some video work. I could help out a little. And, you know, I thought, oh, well, maybe he'll help us a little. That was really my expectation, that he might just do a tiny bit of help, you know, which anything was going to help. So we accepted. But, you know, Kyle came on the team, and he really made a huge difference. He not only knew how to videograph and edit, but he was available. He happened to be in between jobs in the critical period, and so he was available with time to do a lion's share of the work. Kathy was doing an amazing amount of work too, in different areas like our webpage. But Kyle was able to film some videos. He was able to edit. He edited a full half of the videos we launched with. And then we were looking for music, and I was just wondering what we were going to do for music. And then Kyle goes, oh, I could do the music. And so it turned out that Kyle, I had no idea, is a fantastic musician, and he basically did 99% of our, well, not 99, but 90% of our music. And it was just great to have access to someone who could do it without royalties, because we didn't have a budget. And so basically it all seemed inspired. So anyway, that it kind of all came together in an amazing way with everyone that was involved. But Kyle, maybe you can, do you mind telling us a little bit about the experience? You know, you first interviewed your family, your own family, mm-hmm. and that's part of this presentation right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't think I was ever going to do something like this. I'm a very private person normally, and I don't know, just one day I was driving down the street and got this really strong impression that came over me that I have this gift that's been given to me where I have received this answer after, you know, my family had this experience of kind of, you know, learning about Christ-like love. And I felt like I wasn't sharing this precious gift that God gave me and that God wanted me to share it. And I was like, well, then, and my first initial thought was, well, maybe I could share my story on a Gay Mormon Stories podcast. And so that's when I wrote the email. Yeah. And I had no idea that it was going to turn into a YouTube video of me, like, being on a video on YouTube. That was kind of crazy, but yeah, and I didn't think my parents would be up for that either, because they're even more private people than I am. And so,
yeah.
But amazingly, At first, they didn't really like the idea. But then as they thought about it, they decided, well, maybe, you know, this is a good thing. And I decided to interview them one of the weekends I was home, and my mom was just like, well, let's just do it tonight. And I was like, okay. And she's like, I just know I might change my mind if we don't do it tonight. Let's do it tonight. And so we did. But
make hay while the sun shines.
Yep.
Well, it was a fantastic interview. Your parents are excellent, and they did an amazing job. And I know you're kind of disappointed that the sound wasn't so great for them. Your mic kind of gave out. But yeah, in spite of that, it was just a fantastic video that you guys made, both your long and your short one. And your brother was also just so fantastic in his interview. So I was really pleased with your family. And
oh, thanks.
We thought it was just kind of a perfect video to launch with because it just really gave such a complete range of the stories. So it was part of our initial rollout.
Yeah, it's amazing the impact it's made too, how many people have watched it. So
yeah.
I mean, this is the first time I've ever been public about my sexual orientation. And I wasn't sure how much I would like that, how comfortable I would feel being so out in the open about it. But yeah, it's actually turned out to be really, really good and has given me a lot of experiences, so like growing experiences. So I'm glad I did it.
Just having people in your community basically all become aware in one moment to the next.
Yeah, and like especially relatives, like going to family gatherings. And at first it felt like, you know, I was showing up with my pants down, like it was very uncomfortable. And I was like, oh, yeah, gosh, I feel so exposed. But then just seeing the love that all my family returned on both sides of my family, it was like they really went out of the way to let me know that they still cared about me as their relative and that didn't matter. So that was really cool to see. I just am like, man, have I just lucked out that I have like so much support on all sides? I mean, whether or not they actually support how I'm choosing to live my life, that's one thing. But the fact that they're willing to show so much love for me, that's a huge, that's all I could ask for, really. So
yeah. Well, that's fantastic. Well, and there were some other experiences, you know, for me, I was mainly involved in doing interviews. I did some of the editing, but mainly the interviews. And it was just really special for me to meet all these amazing families. And we basically, you know, like Andy Warhol says, you just turn on the camera and making a movie is easy. All you do is turn on the camera. And that's what I felt like I was doing. Somehow all these amazing families came to my awareness, and all I had to do was turn the camera. And all we had to do was just, you know, put together basically the message that they gave us. But one particular family that was kind of inspirational was the Dean family. And it was a really tough one. They were super generous to give us their story because Matthew Dean, his brother, had committed suicide. And this is really tough on a family. But Matthew and Liz really learned a lot from their experience with their brother. And they had some regrets, and they really wanted to put it out there to help other people, you know, in memory of their brother. And I thought it gave them a lot of vulnerability. I was even nervous about editing it because when they talk, it was like they were taking full responsibility for their brother's death. And, you know, that's not fair because they were just going with what their beliefs were, right? It's what they were taught. But B, they also, you know, they really came around, and even while their brother was alive, were really trying to help him. And so they, you know, fortunately for them, they were able to sort of have their epiphany before he died, and it gave them a chance to at least express their love to him, even though they felt like, you know, in the end, you know, they weren't able to save him. But I just thought it was beautiful of them to share that in that difficult time. And it seemed like such an important story, and most of our the Walk With You interview were really upbeat and positive and happy and had good outcomes because that was what we wanted to do, was we wanted to show the ideal world. But this was one that it wasn't such a happy ending, right? It wasn't what we wanted, and we were showing a contrast. So we just felt like we really had to get it right. So I sort of was playing around with editing, but we just, on that one, we just felt so strongly that wanted it right, that I kind of decided to turn it over to Kyle because I felt like he was more of our local expert for crafting these videos and trying to put it out there in a fair way to them that was also moving. And you know, do you mind talking about that experience?
Yeah, sure. So that was an interesting experience because I hadn't seen any of the footage. Like, I wasn't the one who filmed it. Like, you, Dan, were the one that actually filmed the video. And so watching the entire extended version, and it was so powerful and so heartbreaking that I was bawling my eyes out and just, oh, this is so tragic. And then I'm like, okay, now I have to go through the whole thing again and cut it piece by piece and put it together. And having to play it over and over again, and like every time I was crying just as hard. And there were moments when I had to stop and get up and like do something else for a little bit and like calm myself down, you know, to not be such a ball baby. But it was interesting because I ended up having a really strong impression while I was taking one of my little breaks from it, realizing that this was something really important to their brother Jared, and that he really wanted that story out. It was almost like he was right there with me, and I felt like he was there making sure that everything I was doing was to the greatest that it could be, so that the message could really come across. And that was really powerful. I ended up sharing that with Matt and Liz. But
yeah,
that was really cool.
Well, and Matt and Liz were super pleased with how that turned out. And like I say, they were so generous, and their video really proved to be really, really compelling, and it was widely shared. And, you know, Matt had been public about his story. He wrote a book. But just knowing that you had that same sort of confirmation, because they really also felt like that God had really, they had gotten sort of a message that they should share their story too. And, and they kind of, you know, Liz kind of said, you know, no one should go through that. And I think Jared made you feel that too, that he didn't want people to suffer to what he suffered. And so it was really, you know, profound for you, for me, and for them, just to see that happen. So, I'm really, really grateful to the deans, and you know, it was just a neat experience for all of us to do that. So, we were certainly feeling guided in that process.
Yeah, I felt a lot of guidance, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, so that kind of brings us to the now, and we're still, you know, rolling out the videos. We're hoping that that people will submit more of the videos, but we've only released 10 of them, and there's like 30 more in the pipeline. So people are going to see those roll out for quite a while yet. And Kyle's even hopefully going to film a few more interviews too, to add to that. Although, you know, we actually are more behind on the video editing than anything. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Still need to get on that.
And Kyle got a job, and
full-time job.
So he's no longer available to give us 40 to 60 hours a week on this. But anyway, I'm super grateful to Kyle for that. And the rest of the team, Berta and Kathy, and Berta and Kathy actually got acquainted through the project. They didn't know each other, and now they're this power activist couple. They're super activists. They both have these aspirations, and they're hanging out together a lot, you might say. And so anyway, so Kyle, let's kind of come back, you know, because that was what you and I has always talked about. We seem to never talk about anything else except the video project. So I know surprisingly little about you for how many conversations we've had, but why don't you just tell me a little bit about your aspirations for the future? I know you are trying to kind of make a career decision before you go back to school. I know.
Yes.
I've already found out that you want to get married and have kids.
Yeah, definitely.
To a guy.
Yes.
Married to a guy and have kids. So do you have more to say about that?
Well, I'm really, this is one of those things that I'm kind of putting in God's hands for now, and I'm not really worrying about the whole dating situation because I know it'll just work out. Right now I'm working at a bank as a teller. I really like that job. Right now I'm figuring out, because I was going pre-med, like all through college, I was wanting to become an eye surgeon. And about like a year or two before, let's see, well, like 2 or 3 years, I think it was about 3 years into it, I started wondering if that's really what I wanted to do. Especially like I ended up working in an OR in St. George for a summer. And that, like being around the surgeons and talking with them about what it's like and, you know, their complaints about it sometimes, you know, the perks of the job and some of the challenges of the job. I started thinking, well, yeah, I would probably do really well and, you know, make a lot of money. But I was just feeling like, well, I'm not sure that that's particularly what I want to do. So I just decided to start exploring other things like film, for example. That's why I knew so much about film by the time we had come along, or I'd come along with this project. Took some classes in that. I'm currently writing a book, actually. So I'm just kind of, right now, what sounds good to me is nursing. Nursing is a good option for me, I feel like, because I'm so tired of school. I don't want to go through 8 more years of school to become a surgeon.
Yeah.
but a nurse sounds like a good idea, or advancing in banking, because that's working really well for me right now. I really enjoy math and talking to people, and I'm learning a lot about finances. And then...
So it's kind of wide open for
you.
Yeah,
so it's kind of pretty wide open right now.
Yeah.
This is the year of me really deciding what it is I really want to do. So. Yeah.
Well, I wish you good luck with that.
Oh, thanks.
Well, Kyle, it's all going to happen for you. You're a great guy. And Kathy and I and Berta, every time we see a cute Mormon guy who seems really nice, we'll go, oh, you need to meet Kyle. So... Kyle, we've been annoying Kyle because we go, oh, do you want to meet this guy? Do you want to meet this guy? But Kylo says, well, let's just let it happen naturally if it's going to happen. So he's kind of hasn't taken us up on our offers to introduce him to people. But we recommend Kyle for anyone who's out there. But now he's going to want me to delete this podcast.
And no, it's
let's
all right.
Let's see if I do.
It's all right. Don't worry about it.
Well, Kyle is... Thanks a lot for sharing your story. And
yeah, thanks for the interview.
I'm hoping people will take that from you. And this message that you had, I resonate with the part about that it was hard to really ask God a question if you weren't willing to accept his answer.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to accept whatever the answer is. And sometimes the answer is not in the same box that you... or expecting it, right?
Yep.
And you kind of realized you weren't going to get the answer until you were actually open to all possibilities. So
yeah.
I really want to encourage people with that idea. And I think it's nice for people to have an example that, yeah, they can get an answer from God, and they can also maintain their values. They can maintain as much of the church as... they want. They don't have to run away and go off the deep end, which unfortunately too many people do in a dangerous way. So I really want narratives like yours to be out there visible for people. So I appreciate your sharing it with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Okay. Well, so thanks for joining us, the Game Mormon Story audience. We're really hoping that this interview will also be followed up, because Holly Hancock tells me she is going to interview Kathy Carlston. So you'll get to even hear more from the Walk With You team that has gotten to be such good friends in the past year by our involvement with the project, where we really didn't know each other much before that. So anyway, until next time, over and out.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see the podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation today at gaymormonstories.org. Music for this podcast was graciously donated by Nabby Parkinson Folk and Ricky Parkinson.
That thou hast shown, pause to help and lift another, finding strength beyond my own. Savior, may I learn to love thee. To judge.